You're listening to the Salon Owners Collective podcast, where each week we share stories and expertise from business owners like you, plus experts, influencers, and Larissa's actionable steps that will transform your business and your life. And now your host, Larissa McLemon.
Hi, how are you? Years ago, I won a business award. It was the Global Salon Business Award. I won it 3 times, in fact. Now, on one occasion, I was in London to receive the award and I connected with the fantastic hairdresser. So today I would like to introduce you to Alan Austin Smith. He is the founder of the Fantastic Hairdresser and many other talents and resources to help you out as a salon owner. Now, with 30 years in business, he is still leading the industry and doing business just like he started it yesterday, full of fresh ideas and initiatives. I know you're going to love this interview with Alan because it's full, I mean packed full. It's longer than usual, so I'm warning you, but it's worth it. There's lots of awesome insights and some deep questions to ask yourself as a business owner, like, is what you're doing actually working? So let's jump straight into the interview. Welcome, Alan. I'm so pleased to have you on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here, Larissa. Lovely to see you. Lovely to speak to you again after all these years.
That's right. Now, we met years and years ago, I think 2006. We were on a bus together in London at the Global Salon Business Awards, and we were on our way to an event.
Yeah, we were on our way to the House of Commons.
We were. That's right. Good memory. So it's been a while and we are on opposite sides of the world. It's 8 o'clock here at night and it's 9 o'clock in the morning where you are.
Absolutely.
So I'm very pleased to have you join me. What I would love to do, you are the founder of the Fantastic Hairdresser. And I remember it from all those years ago, so I'm really looking forward to hearing about it. But please do tell us, why were you at this Global Salon Business Awards? And tell me about your business and what's changed between now and then.
Well, the first time we met, which was in London, which I was a judge at the Global Business Awards, and also I was speaking. I was a speaker at the event. And then also was a judge throughout its history. Unfortunately, it's no longer with us anymore. The recession killed that because it killed off the sponsors. which was a shame because it was a great event.
It was.
But give a little bit of history for people who don't know anything about the Fantastic Hairdresser or me. I mean, we're 30 years old now. Next year. It's our 30th birthday.
Wow, congratulations.
That's the business, not me, unfortunately. it all started, I guess, way, way back when I was a wee little 16-year-old when I decided to become a hairdresser. It was an overnight decision. It wasn't something that I'd been planning on. I hadn't been doing my Action Man's hair when I was 7, dreaming about becoming a hairdresser one day. It's quite a funny story, actually. I had a girlfriend who was a hairdresser. The salon was doing a little fashion show, hair and fashion show, and they needed a couple of extra male models, dragged the boyfriends in, and I was a model.
I love it.
Changed my life, because that day I decided, hey, this is cool, and I decided to become a hairdresser. I always joke that, well, it was not a joke, actually, it was true, but there was 4 things that made me decide that I discovered that day why I decided to become a hairdresser. The first was I saw amazing creativity, and I'd always been a creative person. The passion of the people involved. And then the other two were, I saw lots of women everywhere I looked. and afterwards we went out for a party. So I always say that the 4 reasons I became a hairdresser was creativity, passion, women, and party. I
think and it served you well, no doubt.
Absolutely, it's good balance. Yeah. So that was my starting point. I told my mum I was going to be a hairdresser, and she was very excited. I was quite surprised, but of course, I didn't realise then that she'd already worked out she would never going to have to pay to have her hair done again for the rest of her life. and so she gave me some advice. She said, look, if you're going to do it with the best. And I said, that sounds like good advice. Who's that? And she said, well, the only name that I know is Vidal Sassoon. And so off I toddled. Did my apprenticeship with Sassoon's in New Bond Street in London. And that was my first 3 years. I spent a couple of years there working there. And then moved on to another large company, American company that had a lot of salons in the UK. And I was creative director of one of their London salons. So I was sort of doing all the fun, creative director stuff, the shows and the shoots and all of that stuff, which was great. But then I was sort of getting a little bit itchy feet. I loved educating because the creative director role had taken me more into the education stuff. And as much as I loved, you know, doing all the creative stuff and doing here, I loved educating and teaching. And L'Oreal approached me, and I became an educator for L'Oreal. Then I became technical manager, and then latterly involved in the business development management side of things. That was really where things started to change. I often say that the first part of my career, I was passionate about what we do. The second part of my career, I became very passionate about what we're not doing. Mm-hmm. And it was there that I started to see that at L'Oreal. To be fair, I'd had a very charmed entry into this industry. Sassoon's in Bond Street and then creative director for a London salon, part of a big American group with hundreds of salons. And all of a sudden I was seeing normality, you know, normal, good quality salons, but realizing, why are you not doing that? And this works much better. And your team aren't motivated because you're not doing this and so on. And that really was the start of what is still all these years later, my passion. It was from that I decided to leave L'Oreal and set up what was to become the Fantastic Hairdresser. We actually started a company called Take Control, because I felt that's what needed to happen.
Yeah.
And actually thinking about it, I've never really occurred to me that at that time that was what was needed to happen. And I think we changed and evolved into the Fantastic Hairdresser as I realized that taking control was only part of the journey that needed to be taken. So, as I say, at this time, it was Take Control, and it was really looking at how to help salon businesses and salon owners, etc., have more control over their business, over their life, over what they were doing, be more profitable, whether it was the inverted commas, boring stuff, the system standards, procedures, contracts, and everything else, and then the sort of sexier stuff in terms of communication and how we communicate and motivate people, et cetera, marketing and everything else. So we covered everything, finance, whatever.
Yeah.
And we still do. We cover everything we do there. I decided to take quite a risky, I suppose, approach, but it paid off. And that was, I noticed that a lot of my competitors at that time were very much focusing on the problems people were having with their business. And I thought, well, if I'm going to compete, I need to stand out. I need to be different. I need to approach things differently, which has been a theme of my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to do the exact opposite, and I approached the successful salons.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm now sort of knocking on the doors of Trevor Sorby and Charles Worthington, and Tony and Guy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Bearing in mind, Tony and Guy, we're talking 30 years ago, there was 3-4 salons. So I'm talking to these guys, Guy Kremer, Sean Hanna, you know, whatever. And they're all very nice and so on, but they were very nicely saying, Alan, you know, we think you're very good and we like you, but to be honest, we're doing quite well. Yeah. And my answer every time was, yeah, you are, but I just don't think you're doing as well as you could be. And of course that piqued their interest, and they said, well, what do you mean? And then I would show them some different things and they would be interested, and I'd start working with them. And so we built the origins, if you like, started right at the top. And of course that worked. Let's say it could have backfired, but it actually worked, and it worked in the way that, of course, people would then be going, okay, so this is the guy that's working with Trevor Sorby, this is the guy that's working with Charles Worthington, etc. Yeah. And then we got what I call the normal good quality salons that started to come to us and whatever. We're the number one now in the UK in terms of business development and team development education. We're also the only company that crosses global borders. There's great companies where you are in New Zealand yourselves and so on, in Australia, in America, etc. There's great companies that do exactly the same thing as we do in very high quality ways. But what we're quite proud of is we're the only ones that actually is in Australia, is in US, Russia, Croatia, Scandinavia, etc., other parts of Europe and whatever. So we do cross boundaries because we have ambassadors. Obviously, we were just talking about Steve in Australia, who's our ambassador there, and we have ambassadors in the US and so on, and all around the world. And so that's, again, something that we're very proud of in terms of the fact that we are global in that way, and that the message is relevant wherever you are. And I've found that, I've always questioned that, you know, when I'm in Russia, for example, I'm thinking, is this a relevant message? And every time it is, I think salons around the world are facing exactly the same challenges. And you know, anything we can do to help that is great. So that's
almost reassuring to hear that.
Yeah, and it is. I think I sometimes what I find is the challenges are at different places on the history path. So, for example, Eastern Europe is behind. I don't mean that in a negative way. In that they always tell me when I'm there that you have to remember our industry is only 20 years old.
Wow.
Because in communist Europe, it was, you know, hairdressing was a state job. You know, every haircut was the same price. Every hairdresser paid the same money. There was no passion and creativity. It was just a state job, and so on. So it's all very different. But they're still facing the same challenges. But they might be the challenges we were facing 20 years ago, and so on, which is interesting. So yeah, that was how it all kicked off. That's how it all started. And then where it all changed, I think this is very, very relevant message. Where it changed was about halfway through that journey, probably about 15 years in. We were very successful, doing very well, recognized as good at what we were doing. But I still kept hearing salon owners speaking to me saying, look, this is great stuff and I'm learning so much, but I'm actually more frustrated with my business now than I was before. It's a little bit, I don't know if you know the model where you move from unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence. Yeah. In other words, you can't teach anybody until they're aware they don't know it.
That's right.
and it was almost as though when salon owners were unconsciously incompetent, it's a horrible word, but that's the model. But
blissfully unaware.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's nice. And so everything was going on, but knew it wasn't working. All of a sudden, they're doing programs with myself and other people and so on, and learning all this great stuff and going, wow, this is fantastic, and putting it into action. But now, almost now you know what's wrong and what needs to change, it's almost more frustrating.
That's right.
And the frustration that I was hearing all the time was, I get it. I'm now so focused and knowing my numbers, knowing what I'm doing, and you know, focused on my goals and all of that. But my team don't seem to get it. You know, I can't engage my team. And I was looking at this and I was thinking about it, and I could see that it was so key. It was so critical. You know, there's a question I ask sometimes. The question I ask an audience quite often is, if you could only choose one thing, what is the most critical factor for success in the salon industry? And people come up with all sorts of answers: customer service, the customer experience, you know, obviously hairdressing quality, the atmosphere of the salon, blah, 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 blah. Consistency, profit, all of those things people come up with. But the actual answer is the team. Because all of those things that you want to achieve, profit, customer service, high quality hairdressing, consistency, great atmosphere in the salon, and so on and so on, they all come via the team. Everything that any business owner wants to achieve or needs to achieve has to be done via the team.
Yeah.
So therefore, the team is the most critical factor. And so what we were doing was we were teaching the leaders all this great stuff, but leaving the team behind.
Yep.
And, you know, okay, you do the occasional customer service chat or someone from one of the product companies would come in and do a talk, but it certainly wasn't, you know, consistent in that way. I mean, you will be aware of our one of our foundation stones here, which is the 50% rule. And that is, I believe that 50% of what makes a fantastic hairdresser, not just a good hairdresser, we'll talk about that later, but 50% of what makes a fantastic hairdresser has got absolutely nothing to do with a pair of scissors or a tin brush.
Correct.
And everybody today, apart from the odd dinosaur, everybody agrees with me on that. And so my next question, whenever anybody in the hairdressing industry agrees with my 50% rule, my next question is, okay, well, if you agree with that, then I've got a question for the industry. And my question for the industry is, are we then only teaching young hairdressers to do half their job? You see, we're very good in this industry at teaching someone to do what they need to do with a pair of scissors and a tint brush. And we end up with a 18, 19, 20-year-old who does hair excellently. But they don't always have the other skills. The communication, the social skills, the confidence, the motivation, etc. And then they can't build a column. And then they get demotivated because they're not earning the money, they're getting pressure from their salon owner, and it all goes downhill from there. And I see that happen time after time after time. So effectively what I noticed, what I realized was that we'd actually forgotten the team. In that when the industry 25, 30 years ago went, you know what, we've got to teach these salon owners how to run their business, nobody actually thought about the fact that we've also got to teach the team how to run their own business.
And is this where the Fantastic Hairdresser was born?
Absolutely.
Because this is about the hairdresser, not the salon
Absolutely.
Owner?
Absolutely. It was then, this is the key moment, and it was the key moment because it was then that I realized we need to create the same level of education for the team member as we do the salon owner.
Yeah.
And so, for example, at the Fantastic Hairdresser, we have two, in fact, three very clear areas. We teach the team, we teach the leader, and we teach the business. And all three of those sometimes come together, but all three of those have different needs. And that was where, and it started with me saying, well, we need something. And so I wrote the Fantastic Hairdresser book.
Now, I just have to say, excuse the word, but it is a fantastic book because I think when we met at the Global Salon Business Awards, you had just launched it. Does that sound about right?
Yes, because it was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Right, yeah.
What struck me about the book was that you completely designed it for hairdressers. It's not a normal book.
No.
It's colourful, it's bright, it's full of pictures and drawings. There's no long screeds of text. Hairdressers actually would want to pick it up and you could almost pick it up and open it. I've got a copy myself. You can pick it up and open it and just sort of read it. You don't read it from the beginning to the end. Am I right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. See, and again, but I always try and make sure that anything I say has got value for the listener in terms of education as well. So, you know, you've got to know your customer. You've got to know your customer. And too many times, particularly in a creative industry like ours, we run our businesses from our perspective, not necessarily from the customer's perspective.
Yeah.
Now, of course, that you should always have your own beliefs and everything else in there. I'm not saying that. But, you know, if you just do things from the way you want to do them, that doesn't necessarily mean your customer wants it.
Yeah.
We were at Salon International a few years ago, and our stand was I think it was about 15-foot high book. So the Fantastic Hairdresser was, you know, like twice the height of me, maybe bigger than that, whatever, this huge book. Now, if you know the book, it's lime green, the front cover.
Yeah.
And I remember walking in, the stand had all been set up, and I walked in, there was a Vader next to us, and there was some lovely other furniture places, and whatever, and there was all these classy, you know, beautiful Vader-type stands, and my lime green book standing in the middle of it all, and I was like, oh, I wish I had a nice coffee table book, you know, like a classy, you know, coffee table. In other words, what I'm saying is, I would like it to be a classy,
yes,
Trevor Sorby-ish coffee table book if I had a book, but that wouldn't have worked. And
no,
it's actually stopping and going, you know, this is what works. By the way, just out of interest on that, you picked up on a very important point. The colours and the graphics and everything else, sometimes a non-hairdresser picks it up and says, oh, I see, pretty colours for the hairdresser. And it's like, no, that's not quite what it is. What it was when, if you need to know, you want to know your customer, you've got to talk to them and you've got to learn about them. And so I started saying, look, what do you read? And the answer, of course, was magazines. That's a generalization, but I'm pretty sure everybody agrees. And it was magazines. So actually, we created the book to work like a magazine.
Yeah.
The very first draft had images. And then it looked like a magazine, which is a throwaway item, which we didn't want. So that's when we made it more graphically designed. But all the headlines, the headings, the graphics, and the colors are simply to break it up like a magazine. It fills lots of different things. But the most important thing was I wrote it in what's called double page spreads, which is basically how a magazine is written. Now, if you are a book reader, you read it from page one to page whatever. If you're not, if you're a magazine reader, I always say to people, just pick up my book, open it anywhere.
Read.
And then pick it up again another time and open it anywhere and read, because you can do that. And then you'll end up reading the whole book.
It's the kind of book you can keep in the back room and leave lying around for your team.
Totally.
Once you've forced them to take it home and read it, of course.
Yes, but I also say it's not a book you. None of my books, I don't think, are books that you read and put on the shelf and say, I read that. I love seeing my books beaten up and battered and written in people's bags, and people keep them there all the time. It's quite interesting when we did it. We actually took it to some publishers first of all, and the publishers didn't want the color. They just wanted normal book, black print, white paper. And I knew that wasn't going to work. So we decided to self-publish, which turned out to be a great decision. But when you self-publish, of course, the difficult thing is how many to print. And we looked at the UK market, and there's 30,000 salons. Realistically, 15,000 of those, half of them were never going to get anywhere near the book. So we reckoned there was a market of 15,000, and we thought, well, if we got 20% of that market to buy the book, that would be awesome, which is 3,000 books, and that's what we printed. We were a little bit out on our targeting because we've just literally just hit 170,000 odd.
Well done.
Around the world, and both most of our distributors all tell us that it's their best-selling book. So we sort of, without having absolute numbers around the world, we're fairly confident in saying it's the best-selling book of choice in the salon industry. So it's been amazing.
Congratulations. And I'm going to put the links of the book on the podcast page of this episode. So you can go to, obviously you can actually go to the Fantastic Hairdresser and get it there, but also it will be on my site too.
Cool.
So, all right. So you've been around for a while. You've got some tips to share with us. And I was rather mean only letting you do three, because I know that you've got a wealth of knowledge to share. So why don't you dive on in with your first tip for us?
Okay, well, actually this first one rolls on nicely from what we've just been talking about that move I made to realizing we've got to get the team involved and engaged. I call it the boardroom to the changing room. From the boardroom to the changing room, I'm hearing all the time people telling me, where's the passion gone? Young people today, it's just a job. They're not passionate about it. Part of that is us being old gits and remembering what it was like when we were younger, et cetera, et cetera. And that's always going to happen. But I do think it's a valid point. And I think that there is a generation that do have other interests and so on. The millennials, there's lots of talk about this, of course, and the way they operate differently. And it is more difficult to engage them. And the reason why, quite simply, is because their attention is drawn into so many different areas. Mm. If you think when some of us were younger, if we were into hairdressing, we sat with a dolly head between our knees and we were doing stuff and whatever. But these guys are on their phones, on the level, as I am, as you are. We're all doing it, and there's so many distractions drawing people away. So I think it's very valid. Part of it is cultural. Part of it is the way the world is moving. And I think what we've got to look at is, it's one of my favorite communication quotes of all time, and that is, the archer doesn't blame the target when they miss.
I love that.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
And ultimately, as communicators, in other words, what I'm saying is when sell owners say, oh, my team aren't passionate, it's like, well, what are you doing to make them passionate? You can't just expect passion. You can't demand it. You develop passion. And if you actually look back, of course, we all have very asymmetric memories. We only remember the good stuff. But if you remember back yourself in your life, there were a few people that were incredibly passionate at 16, but most people developed that passion. I certainly did. My passion developed in the industry. It wasn't there. I told you my story. It wasn't there when I was 16. Mm. And the people around me developed that passion. What worries me is that if we've now got a generation that aren't passionate, the next generation aren't going to be passionate either. They're going to have even less passion because you get that passion from the people around you. And in particular, the person who it's most important to is the team leader, is the salon owner. Because if I'm a salon owner, I need my team passionate. You know, the team is the most important factor. It's the most critical factor. We just mentioned that. And so if they're not actually operating at the level I need them to with the passion and creativity and commitment and motivation, then it's not going to happen. Or whatever, however good I am, it's just never going to happen. And so the absolute key is getting that team engaged and involved. So if your team isn't passionate, if you feel your team isn't motivated or committed, I think we've got to stop pointing that finger and saying, you know, my arrows keep missing the target, and saying, maybe I need to change aim. Maybe I need to do something different. And so I looked very carefully. Now, motivation. How do you motivate a hairdresser? You know, it's the golden rule of motivation is everybody's motivated by different things. We all know that. However, in certain businesses, in certain industries, there are common factors, and certainly in our business there is. And when you look at the motivation of a hairdresser and what motivates hairdressers, in fact, I'm going to switch it for a second. I'm going to look at what doesn't motivate hairdressers. And one of the first things is money. And let me explain that. I like money. I'd like more. If you want to give me some, I'll take it. Thank you very much. That doesn't mean I'm motivated by it. Mm. There's a difference between liking it and wanting it and being driven by it. And I think most hairdressers I know like money, would like more, and will take it if I give it to them. But is that the reason they get out of bed every morning? Is that the reason why they do what they do? Now, the reason why I question that is because I don't think most hairdressers would have made it through the first 2-3 years if that was your motivation.
We wouldn't have got into it in the first place.
Precisely. So don't get me wrong. I'm not saying money isn't important and we don't want it and like it and everything. I'm just saying I'm questioning, is it the driver and motivator that it's cracked up to be? Now, for some people it is, but I'm actually talking about the majority. See, I think part of the problem is that if you've got a team of 10 people, you've got two that are driven. We need to be the other way around. You know, if there's one or two that are being driven and motivated by the way that we're motivating, then that's great. But what about the other 6 or 8? And so it's finding a way to get those guys engaged and motivated. So I'm not saying money isn't a motivator. I'm just saying I don't believe it is the motivator. If anybody out there listening to me agrees with that, then you've got to press the pause button and look at what we're doing in the industry to try and motivate hairdressers, because we keep using money. In our commission structures and our incentives and everything we do. And they're great short-term motivators, but not long-term. So that's the first one. However, this is the big one for me. In all the hairdressers you've ever met, Larissa, how many, if you put them all in a room, how many hairdressers do you know that get excited, motivated, engaged, enthused, energized by spreadsheets, computer printouts, and percentages?
Okay, so I worked out that I've employed well over 100 people in the time of being a salon owner, and I can count the number of people who were motivated by things on not using all my digits on one hand.
Absolutely, exactly. And you know, and it's you know, when you interview a young person for a hairdresser, you say, you know, why do you want to be a hairdresser? Has anybody ever turned around to you and said, I love percentages and numbers, and my friend works for you and tells me that you sit down every month and go through them, and I'm really excited about that. It's basically, what I'm simply saying is that we're using stuff to try and motivate hairdressers, that doesn't motivate them. And in fact, turns them off. Now, I often joke that the evolution of a hairdresser over the last 10 years is they've learned to nod wisely, much like men have learned over the years. and effectively, hairdressers used to complain. You say, I'm a hairdresser, I'm creative, stop trying to make me do all this stuff. And now they just shut up. They just nod and go, yeah. And what's happening is you're having one-to-ones and team meetings with people, and you think, well, that seemed to go quite well, but then nothing changes because all they were doing was nodding so they could get back out. And by the way, the reason why they wanted to get out was because they wanted to go and do that thing they absolutely adore, that thing they love doing more than anything else, hair. Mm. You know, the reason they became a hairdresser. I believe we're actually sucking the passion and the creativity out of this industry. And I'm a great believer in the pendulum concept. I don't know if you're aware of it. But basically it says it's difficult to talk about this without a visual. But effectively, if you imagine a pendulum from one side to the other, to get to the middle, which is where you want to be, the pendulum has to swing past to come back again. And that pendulum principle means that if where you're starting from, the salon industry having not a clue in many cases about how to run a business, we almost needed to go past the point we need to be to come back to it. And I feel that what we've done is we moved to a point where we're doing really good stuff. And if anybody's sort of engaged with this thinking, what's he saying? We shouldn't be measuring our business. Just hang on, wait. but we've moved past that and done all this stuff. It's now time to move back into the middle to get to where we are. So let me explain this how I just use the boardroom to the changing room. I use it as a soccer analogy. So here in the UK, if a Premier League football team, if you're the manager of a Premier League football team, soccer team, you are sitting in the boardroom in the off season, and the financial director is very clearly laying out the objectives. We want to increase ticket revenue by X percent. We want to increase merchandising by such and such. We want to increase food and beverage sales by this. And you would be very clear of what the company's goals and objectives are. Now, even if you know absolutely nothing about soccer, sport, or anything else, you'll still be able to engage with this. In your right mind, would you now leave that boardroom and go into the changing room, sit down with the team, and start discussing the fact that you're going to grow ticket revenue and how we're going to increase food and beverage sales? Not in a million years.
Yeah, I love that analogy because it pulls us out of, we're so in our own businesses, and it pulls us out of it and makes you realise the gap of what we're doing. Yeah, great analogy. Absolutely. Yeah, well, beautifully said.
And then I always say, what would you talk about? And everybody says, well, football.
Yeah.
Because actually your job as the manager of that team is to motivate, educate, train, coach in sport, obviously, those players to play football really, really well.
Yeah.
And if they do, they will win more games. And if they win more games, more people come and watch them. And more people buy the shirts. And more people will buy a bun and a coffee and so on. In other words, you will achieve the company's goals by getting the team to operate at the highest level.
Yeah.
What I think we've done wrong, in my opinion, it's only my opinion, but I'm entitled to it. what I think we've done wrong in this business over the last 10, 15 years is we haven't translated. In other words, I'm not saying that you shouldn't be all over your numbers. Of course you should, as a salon owner. You need to know absolutely everything about your business. And you should be looking at the percentages and the spreadsheets and everything else. But in the boardroom, in other words, where you do your business, you need to know your business. You need to know where you need to grow. You need to know how many extra clients you need, what you need to increase your average bill by, et cetera, and how you're going to do that and all the rest. But what you've now got to do is translate that when you take it into, in my analogy, the changing room, and communicate to that team in a different way. But what we've been doing is we've been taking the stuff from the boardroom straight to the changing room with no translation. Yep. And these guys are looking at us like we're nuts. And then
professional
eventually,
nodding.
Yes, and then just do their nodding and get on with it. So that's my boardroom to the changing room. What essentially I'm saying is that we've got to change the way we communicate. Now, the book is an example of that. You picked up on that. Okay, I'm just hesitating, so I don't want to talk about any competitors or anything else in the same way, but I look at a lot of books written in the industry, for the industry, and they're written still, even though they're for the team, from the boardroom perspective.
Yeah.
I think what we did with The Fantastic Hairdresser was we wrote a book from the changing room's perspective, and all of our education and everything we do follows that principle. The non-hairdressers in my company, we've got a lot of people working here in different roles now, and sometimes they're working on stuff and they come to me and say, Alan, can you make this hairy? that's the standard thing. In other words, can you bring hairdresser to this?
I used to say that when I worked with Timely Salon Software, I would say exactly that. Now let's turn it hairy. That all have a bit of a giggle, but it's true. And you know what your example you're saying about the book is that this is a saying that I say is meet the people where they're at. Don't try to drag them up to where you are and where you're thinking. Come and meet them where they're at. And speak their own language, right?
And that's the same for your team. Absolutely.
Engagement. Yep.
Cool. So
okay, yeah, fantastic. I love it. Great.
Good. It's amazing how many times you start saying that word when you talk to me, isn't it?
I know. I did notice. Sorry about that.
No, don't say sorry. It happens all the time. I love it when I give someone...
I'm going to have to make it part of the title. Fantastic.
It's like whenever anybody shows someone the book, the first thing they do, they pick it up and they go, oh, fantastic. And they don't realise it. All right, so the next one... is one that's very close to my heart, and it's becoming more and more relevant every day. And it's a question for those of you that are listening. Do you look like a business 5 years in the future or a business 5 years in the past? Because 5 years in the future will be here before we know it. But the speed the world changes today, if you're not thinking about that now, you will be a business 5 years in the past, without question. Everybody knows, but it amazed me when I was looking the other day, I think YouTube is only about 12 years old, 12, 13, it's crazy. It feels like it's been with me my whole life, but it's only 12 years old. One of my favorite things I say to people is Michael Jackson never had an iPad.
Wow. Yeah. When my son has just turned 11, when he was born, Facebook didn't exist.
Yeah.
And that's hard to imagine now. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So in terms of, spin that one out in terms of the fact that the world is changing, it's moving fast, et cetera, et cetera. But what I'm really actually talking about here is that because of the way the world is moving, because of the way it communicates today, it's increasingly difficult to stand out from the crowd. Whether you are an individual stylist, and I think this is a message for stylists as much as it is for salon owner, I always say obviously it depends on the size of the town or the city I'm in, but if there's 10 salons, in your town or city that are operating at a similar standard to you, and each of those 10 salons have got maybe 5 to 10 stylists, well, that's 50 to 100 hairdressers your client can choose from, individual hairdressers. Yeah, that's 50 to 100 stylists, and I think in many cases many more than that, that a client is choosing between, not just salons, actual individual stylists. So as a stylist, you have to stand out from the crowd, but as a business, you have to stand out from the crowd. And I think it's perhaps one of the most critical things in business today. It's noisy out there. There's so many different messages. It's getting noisier all the time. How do you stand out? How do you make your business stand out from that crowd and people notice you? Well, if you look like a business 5 years in the past, you certainly aren't going to be standing out from the crowd.
No.
Now, for me, this is about looking at your business, and it's not trying to predict 5 years in the future because nobody can. But it's actually looking and thinking, what are we doing now? What are we doing to embrace what's new and exciting and different now? So for example, I'm seeing more and more salons now, thank goodness, but it took quite a while for our industry to catch on to having a tablet in the salon, or certainly having two or three. And by the way, it doesn't have to be an iPad. You know, you don't have to spend 500 quid or whatever it is there. You know, you don't have to spend, you can, there's some very, you know, when you think what you need it to do, you effectively need it to connect to the internet. You know, you can pick something up, but still a high quality for 150, 200 quid. Again, I don't know how much that is there, but you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. You know, that's a perfect example. You know, people, you know, how many, again, I don't know if it's happening there, but it's certainly happening here. People don't bring in magazines anymore. They've been in their Pinterest board.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and you're looking at Pinterest boards. Well, you know, those are the sort of thing we should have in the salon and engaging and so on. And again, I don't know there whether it's as key there as it is here, but review sites are critical, absolutely critical. And when you have tablets in the salon, you can actually get people very actively involved with review sites and actually, excuse me 2 seconds, I'll say that again. Because I'll pick that up again and not the microphone. You can get people very actively involved with review sites because you know you've got the tablet actually in the salon. You know, if someone's saying, "Oh, wow, great!" and you ask them to do a review, they can do it there and then, etc. So that's just one example. But you know, I let's be a little bit more radical than that. You know, I often ask people to question whether they need a reception desk anymore. You know, why do we have reception desks? Well, we had them because in the old days, you had this huge book, this appointment book, that took up a huge space, plus a phone and a till and everything, all the other crap that ended up on the reception
and
desk.
And the till rolls and
and all that stuff.
Cash even.
Yes, and so it's like, and again. If for people who don't know me, I'm not saying you should get rid of your reception desk. I'm just saying these are questions I think is really healthy to start asking yourself, even if at the end you go, no, we do need it. But at least you're thinking, and you're thinking about a change and whether things need to be different. You know, we had a salon for a 6-year period when our academy was in a different area, and it was on a high street, so it made sense to have a small salon. And we actually used it as a test area because it wasn't our core business. We were able to take risks. We were able to try something and think, well, if this doesn't work, you know, at least we've learned. Whereas obviously if your salon is your core business, you maybe can't always afford to take those risks. And so we were able to try different things, and whether it's in marketing or whatever. And one of the first things we did was let's take the reception desk out. Let's see how this salon operates as a reception. By the way, one of the reasons why I questioned it was that I do a talk when I'm talking about customer service, and I talk about something called nap bites. And I say nap bites are the tiny little bites you get in a service environment. Very rarely do you lose a customer because of something huge happening wrong. It's actually lots of little things going wrong. And as a consumer yourself, you know that. Yeah. So I talk about nap bites. Well, actually, a high percentage of the nap bites in the hairdressing salon revolve around the reception desk. Almost every salon owner I speak to, would say, oh, you know, drives me mad, they're hanging around the desk, or this is happening, or that's, and so on. So much of it happens around the reception desk. And I was thinking, well, do we need one?
Yeah.
With the technology we have today. And so with tablets in the salon, we had a touch screen on the pillars on the wall where you came in through the door. Our front of house had a headset. We ran it more like a restaurant, because that was my first thought. I thought, you don't have a reception desk in a restaurant. You walk in and someone greets you and says hi, you know, at the door. You don't have to stand in front of this horrible desk. And all of a sudden, without that desk on, we had our front of house was greeting people at the door, opening the door for people when they're arriving and saying hi, and escorting them to the waiting area, which, by the way, we positioned at the back of the salon, because it's always amused me that in this industry, we put people who haven't had their hair done yet in our window.
I'm so pleased you said that, because we actually had no waiting area. We ditched it, and we took people straight through to be seated at the styling bay before exactly that. Why would they put all the people with the bad hair in the window?
Exactly. Yeah, always amused me. And so yeah, we took them to the waiting area, and then, like a restaurant, people paid in the chair, and so our clients actually, they were delivered a bill like on a nice, in the way a restaurant would, a nice little tray with a little lollipop over the top, because otherwise the hairdryer blew the bill away, and so on. And it was put there just towards the end of their blow dry, and it was explained, obviously, it was all explained properly. And all of a sudden everything was being done in a chair. Pre-booking was being done on the chair and a tablet and so on. Now, the interesting thing is that when you do something like that, you have to communicate it properly to the client. So assuming, yeah, obviously it's not a new client, they know how it's done, but a new client. And so what we trained our team to say was, you got to a point when it was there and you say, look, we do things a little bit differently here. That is a great line.
Yeah, yeah.
To say to one, we do things a bit differently here. That's immediately establishing you're out of the crowd. We do things a bit differently here. And then you have to give the customer or anybody you're communicating with a reason to understand. So it was then to say, look, you've probably experienced this before, but actually leaving a hairdressing salon, particularly when it's busy, can be quite stressful. So you've had this lovely, relaxing environment, and then you're trying to get out, and there's three or four people around the desk, and you're trying to pay, and your car's on a meter, and you want to get out, and so on. And it actually ends up can sometimes be a bit stressful.
Yeah.
So
you've left the building already, actually, usually.
Yes.
The client, yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Mentally, so, I mean.
Yeah, absolutely, mentally. And also that's when we're trying to rebook and all that stuff, and they just want to get out and get to them, pick up their kids from school, you know?
Yeah.
And so on. So what what effectively we're saying, we say to the client, so, and every client you say that to goes, oh, yeah, I've had that. So we do things a bit differently here. Louise, our front of house, will give you your bill in a moment. There's no stress, there's no pressure on you. It's just going to sit there when you relax, finish your coffee, and she'll come and sort it out with you in a moment. And it was a relaxed environment for them to settle and pay and everything else. But the difference was because they within the chair, and Louise would come up with the Wi-Fi card machine and all the rest, but she would also have the tablet there, and then she would say, okay, I wasn't doing hair in the salon, I don't do hair anymore, but she might say, would you like me to check Alan's diary for your next appointment? And it was just so natural to do it then, as against doing it at the reception. By the way, I always say never talk pre-booking at the reception desk, because it's the worst place ever to do it, because they've just given you money, and sometimes a lot. That's $150, Larissa. Okay. Would you like to do that again?
Yeah. Would you like to part with your money again? Yes, I like the way you said that.
I'll leave it for the moment. whereas if you do it in the chair, they're enjoying the experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so on. So that was stuff we did with reception. We did marketing stuff that was different. We had what we call the cookie basket. I always had three questions for anybody if I was in the salon, and my management team had the same. And that was, if someone wasn't doing anything, the first question was, are you on a break?
Mm-hmm.
No. Second question, are you waiting for a client? No. Third question, what are you doing then? because at the very least, there's one of two things I'd like you to be doing, learning or marketing yourself, so you're not standing there doing nothing. Nice. But then again, what I understand is you've got to give people a tool. So our marketing tool was, are you on a break? No. Are you waiting for a client? No. Do you want to take the cookie basket out? And they would take that. We had literally it was a basket full of chocolate bars, and we actually end up putting some fruit in there as well, being politically correct, yep, and making sure we're looking after everybody. But basically chocolate bars and things like that. And we also took, we used sort of chocolate bars that people remembered from their school lunches and things like that. They'd probably be different brands there, but those things, remember that, type of thing.
Yeah.
And so we had this basket full of chocolates and all sorts of different things, and you stand out on the street. You see, what other people do is they stand out on the street with price lists.
Yes.
Yeah. And people go, but when you give people chocolate, more people stop.
Yes. Funny that.
Not everybody still, but more. You get more people to stop. And then you'd say, would you like a cookie? Would you like some chocolate? And people would look at you a bit strange and say, yeah. And they'd look at the salon. And people say, why are you giving away chocolates? And our answer was, well, we're called the Fantastic Hairdresser. We're not making people feel fantastic. And people would just engage with you, even those, if you were in a hurry, they'd go, oh, thank you very much. And they'd ask why you were doing it. And you got some engagement. It's much easier then to give them a price list and to do some marketing. But the biggest thing was that we taught them how to understand that, you know, that sometimes people were clear that they actually had a bit more time. They weren't in a rush. Those people, you offered a free consultation to, and you brought them back into the salon. In other words, take the cookie basket out. Oh, I hate that. Yeah, well, don't be out there long then. Get a client back in here.
I love that. I think that's really, really clever. Yeah.
So that was another thing we did. We had the dog cafe. That was incredibly successful. The dog cafe was a dog water bowl outside the salon. But what made it really special was the little sign on a little easel. It was tiny. It was down beside it. And it said dog cafe, stylized sign. And people walked past, even if you didn't have a dog, and you looked at it and you smiled. And you know what? We were getting more engagement from a dog bowl than we were from a £500 advert.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and so on. Then probably one of the best things we ever did in terms of standing out from the crowd and trying to be different was we approached a local coffee shop. And the average price of a coffee was about £2.20. Yeah. And I said, listen, if I came in on a Monday morning and bought 30 coffees off you, would you do it at £1.50? And it was an independent, you know, we're not talking Starbucks or something. Yeah. And they were like, on a Monday morning to get 45 quid. In the till before I've even started work, fab. And so that was the deal. And then we gave them 30 cards. And so gave them £45 every Monday morning and 30 cards. And effectively what that restaurant did, that cafe did, was throughout the week, they randomly bought, or we randomly bought people coffee. So you would have gone into that coffee shop and ordered a latte, and they've done all the stuff, and they turn around, and you're about to pay, and they say, it's okay, the Fantastic Hairdresser bought you that.
Oh, I love that, Alan. It's really, really clever. Really clever. Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. And then, of course, you would say, whoa, what? And then they would hand over the card.
Yep.
And on the front of the card, it said, you may be wondering why we bought your coffee. And then on the back, it just said, we love making people feel fantastic. Have a great day. And our details. No offer. It wasn't conditional. There was no, you know, anything else. It was just simply, have a great day.
Yeah, I bet. There's some really fresh ideas on doing something different. Look, honestly, I don't even have a salon anymore. I could listen to those stories all day. That's awesome. Yeah.
And I mean, I could talk about them all day, as you probably know. But basically, the what I'm trying to give the people that are listening to this is an idea of what, when I say, do you look like a business 5 years in the future? I talked about some technology. I talked about stuff, but it's not just that. It was putting a dog bowl out. It was
just looking at being different. Look at different industries and look at doing something different and stand out from the crowd.
Absolutely.
And you know, you're totally right. All right. I'm looking forward to hearing your last story on always operating like a new business.
Okay. Well, this is kind of weird because in a way this sounds like I'm going back on what I was just talking about, but it's not. And it's one of my favorite bits of advice to people. Always operate as though you're a new business. You see, if you're opening a new salon, think of all the things you do. The marketing things, the training, the induction. You know, if you were opening a new salon, would you get your new team in the week before? Would you be training them? Would you be telling them about your culture, about your goals, about your ambitions, about what the company stands for? Of course you would.
Yeah.
You know, but what happens is that 2 years down the line, you get a new stylist, and the induction is about 5 minutes. It's almost like, well, there's your locker. There's, you know, if you've got any problems, let me know. And so on. So when you opened as a new business, you spent a week getting people ready to work with you.
Yeah.
And then when you actually employ people later on, you don't put them through the same level of structure. And then what happens is that 3, 4, 5 years down the line, you feel like you've lost that energy. You've lost that whole buzz that you had at the beginning. And it's because you're not actually operating your business the way you did at the beginning. marketing. You know, when you open your business, you're engaging, you're connecting with the local community, you're going to the coffee shops, you're saying, what can we do together? How can we do this? You're doing open evenings, you're giving balloons out on the street to kids, you do all this stuff. So whether it's education, and by the way, I'd just like to point to something. When I was talking about the, do you look like a business 5 years in the future, et cetera, and I was talking about, you know, paying in the chair, and I was talking about the cookie basket, I just want to make sure that people picked up on something. I said we trained them how to talk out on the street with a cookie basket. We trained them how to tell the client about the paying in the chair. Sometimes we expect people to do stuff without training to do it. And again, if you're a new salon, if you're a new business, you would train them. You'd walk them through all those processes. You say, look, this is how I want you to greet the client. This is how I want you to. You train them. You motivate them. You spend time with them. You don't forget to do one-to-ones when you've only been open 3 months. You're running team meetings. You're doing everything that we know. The nothing dramatic, just simple stuff. But you're doing it consistently and you're doing it all the time. And interestingly, what makes you busy, the stuff that makes you busy, and you go, you know, a year down the line, 2 years down the line, you go, oh, it's going great. We're hitting all our targets, doing really, really well. We stop doing it. Yeah. We actually stop doing the stuff that made us busy in the first place. And then another year, 2 years goes past and you start to plateau and you go, what's going on? What's happening? We're not as busy as we were. I'm losing staff. I'm all these problems. And it's actually because you're not doing the stuff you did at the beginning. You know, it's always operate as though you're a new business. Now, you mentioned the Global Business Awards.
I did.
This is where I actually really engaged with this. I was a judge at the Global Business Awards, and as you know, it was backed by UCLA. And the reason why I love those awards is I think they had the most integrity of any awards I've ever judged, any business awards I've ever judged. I mean, you had to put tax reports in to enter it.
I remember.
You know, yeah. And I mean, and frankly, if anybody's lying on a tax report, they're lying down, not up. and so on. So I always thought they had great integrity. And UCLA, when they put their sort of brand behind it, they needed it to have that integrity. And so I don't know if you know the judging process, but basically there was three judges in each group, and the idea was an industry leader, of which in my group that was me, and then someone from trade press, and then someone as a business leader who knew nothing about the industry. And so there was 30 judges, 10 industry leaders, 10 from press, and then 10 that were business leaders, nothing to do with the industry. And you worked in groups of three to judge. And then in the corner of it, so we were at UCLA when we were judging this, and you'd be in these different rooms, so there would be me and the other two judges, and then sat in the corner was an invigilator from UCLA, and they sat there, and they watched and listened to everything you said, and they would say, no, you can't say that, no, you can't. And it was amazing. I've never judged anything like that. I mean, it was really, really tough. Anyhow, this particular year, they were really focusing on uniqueness. That it's not just about the numbers and what they're achieving. We are looking for businesses that are doing something completely different. And that was a big, big part of the brief we were given as judges. So anyhow, there was this business in Chicago. Astonishing numbers. I mean, really astonishing numbers. It was something like, I think it was about 1,500 square foot, and it was turning over 7 million.
Wow.
It was like, what? Making great profit, a really amazing business. And we were all three of us like, wow, look at this business. And we said, well, they go through straight away, you know, straight away. How can you not put these guys through? And the lady from UCLA, she said, well, you need to find something unique. And you can't just put them through. You've got to find something unique. So it's pretty unique, 7 million from 1,500 square foot. Yeah. I said, well, no, but it's not just the numbers. Oh, okay, fine. So we took it back again and we started looking through. And then we ran into a problem because this guy wasn't actually doing anything particularly unique. And as I said, it's interesting. I'm sort of sounds like I'm going against my previous thing. It wasn't necessarily doing anything particularly unique. He was doing some really good stuff. But it wasn't anything that any of us were going, wow. You know, he was giving out balloons to kids on the street here, where they gave out cakes, they had open evenings, they had parties, hair parties, they had a great training program, they did all this stuff. But there was nothing that you were like, wow, that's different.
Mm.
And we were really struggling. And this woman from UCLA, she was really tough, she was quite scary, and she was absolutely insisting that we find something unique before we can put them through. And we were like looking at each other going, we've got to put this guy through. And then all of a sudden I said, hey, I've got it. I know what it is. And they all looked at me, what? I said, he isn't necessarily doing anything that wow in terms of totally unique stuff, but he's still doing it. What's mm-hmm. unique about this guy is he's still giving out balloons on the street. He's still having his open evenings. He is operating as though he was a new business 7 years on.
Yeah.
And I said, actually, that's what's unique. And everyone was like, yeah. And the UCLA woman said, yeah, that's cool. And so this person got put through. And ever since then, I've used that little phrase, always operate as though you're a new business. Because if you're a new business, you do all this cool stuff and then you stop doing it. If you always kept that up, you can't lose.
So what's really interesting is that what really is unique is that he's doing all the things consistently all the time.
Absolutely.
Isn't that interesting that actually in itself is unique?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And you know as well as I do that, you know when you look around this industry, it's so creative, it's so wonderful, it's so passionate. In spurts.
Yeah. And look, we're creative people and we want to create something. And once it's created and it's done, who wants to get into repeat mode? So I totally get it. I'm that person myself.
I struggle with it too.
Yeah. But that's when you've got to be smart enough to have a team around you, because actually what I discovered is some people love to consistently, methodically do stuff. Not me. I don't like to consistently, do that.
Yep.
And you just need to find the right people around you who can help you be consistent and consistently operate like a new business.
It's the best thing I ever learned from Branson. Surround yourself with people who are good at what you're not good at.
Yes.
And most people do the opposite. Most people surround themselves with people who aren't good at the things you're not good at because they don't want to be found out. But surround yourself with people who are good at what you're not good at. You know, as a creative person, I hate realists. They spoil all my fun.
Damn them.
They don't just spoil my fun. They spoil it with facts. But I've learned over the years, after 30 years of running my business, as a creative person, and by the way, I'm also a creative person who believes they can do anything. I don't mean that arrogantly. I mean that positively. I've learned that if I haven't got a realist around me, I start jumping off cliffs. I need someone.
You think you can fly?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I need someone that is there to go, great idea, Alan, but if you do it like that, it's going to implode.
Yeah.
You know, and so on. We need to try this and we need to do this and so on.
That's kind of a good lead into as we work towards wrapping up, because you are a creative entrepreneur, what is a quote or a mantra that's kept you going for 30 years strong?
Oh, that's easy. I have quotes and mantras. We haven't got time. I've got thousands of the bloody things. But there is a guiding rule. I don't know whether you call it a mantra, but it's a guiding rule for me. I guess it's a mantra that I have used as long as I can remember. I use it in my personal life. I use it in my business life. I use it as a leader. I use it with my customers. And I equally use it for my customers. In other words, when I'm teaching and educating. So it's very, very simple. It's a three-word question. But interestingly, it's a question that I find often people don't ask or ask enough. And even if they do ask, they don't react to the answer.
Mm.
So the question quite simply is it working? Is what I'm doing working? Now, I always say if the answer is anything less than a resounding yes, it's no.
Yes.
So, for example, is your marketing working at the moment? No, then. You know, and the minute is...
the minute you pause, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
It's no. Yeah. You know, is the way you're managing your personal finances working right now? No, then. You know, it's you know, when someone says yes, then it's yes. Anything else is no.
Yes.
And
yes.
And so so the minute you've answered no to that question, surely there's two more questions. The first one is, what isn't working? You know, why isn't it working?
Yeah.
And then secondly, what have I got to change?
Yeah. And then get to work.
And then get on with it. And you know, yeah. What's actually got to change? And so what I find is A, a lot of people don't ask the question. But B, even if you do ask the question, say, you know, is this working? No, not really. But then do nothing. And then don't change anything.
Yeah.
And so for me, that's and I'll give you some examples in sort of more recent times, if you like, with the business. Are team meetings working? You know, this is from my experience talking to salon owners and so on. Not really. You know, in certain cases, yes, but not really. Why? People run out of content. They run out of things to do. You know, they sort of get, oh, I don't know what to do. I don't want to talk about. So you end up with a list of crap to talk to the team about, which demotivates. Yeah. And from that, I thought, okay, well, let's create team meetings. So we created team meetings online. And team meetings online is 20 team meetings pre-prepared. And it's video clips. There's 60 video clips and over 70 team exercises. And so effectively, anybody who's not as good at team meetings as they'd like to be, there's a resource. That resource comes from me asking the question, is it working? You know, I ask the question, is retail working in the salon industry right now? Has it ever worked as well as it could do? Not really, but is it working well now? Worse than ever. I don't know what's happening there, but we're having massive issues with online and online companies selling salon professional products. So is it working? No, not really. What needs to change? Is the way we're communicating with our team, millennials, working? No, not really. What have we got to change? Is my social media working? That was a question I asked myself. I said, you know what? Everybody says, oh, yeah, you're really good at social media. I said, well, yeah, but I'm not sure if it's doing anything. I'm not sure if it's achieving anything. I might get lots of likes and comments, but I don't know, is that turning into money in my till? I don't know. In other words, if you said to me, is your social media working? My answer would be, well, no then, using my measurement. In which case, I said, well, I need to understand this. And so I spent 2 years going on Google seminars and Facebook stuff and immersed myself totally in it and got all these amazing moments, like eureka moments of like, ah, I get it. And then came out the other side and created a different strategy for ourselves, which is flying. It's now, I run an online marketing course, which I make very clear is not social media. It's an online marketing course because that's the problem. Just as a quick one, by the way, I start my online marketing course with the very first question I say to everybody is, or the first thing I say is, don't be online. That's the very first thing you hear from me on an online marketing course is don't be online. Because that's the problem. Everybody's online. Use
Golly,
online.
I'm intrigued.
The answer is use it. Don't be on it. Use it.
Oh, I see.
So effectively, that's what that mantra is all about. It's all about saying, you know, ask yourself, and if that could be the most important thing anybody ever learns from me. Because if you took that into every area of your life and took action on it, things change.
Well said. Now, you've been on, you did lots of searching online and courses and reading books and podcasts. Tell us, what have you read or listened to recently that you think everybody should read, other than, of course, The Fantastic Hairdresser?
I was going to say, well, there's this fantastic hairdresser, there's The Fantastic Boss.
outside of those fantastic books.
And there's my blog. So outside of those wonderful, fantastic things, there's so much. I mean, I don't know if you remember another one of my mantras is I learn for a minimum of 15 minutes every day. So I'm constantly learning all the time. But there's one book, and the great thing is that he's very active online as well. So if you're not a big reader, you'll be able to follow him and see what he's talking about, that I think is really, really relevant to us. And that's a guy called Seth Godin. He's very prolific. You get loads of stuff from him. Who really seems to, although he tends to be talking to corporate, he understands small business. And he has many books. One that I particularly like is Purple Cow, but the one that I'm actually going to recommend is Tribes. Yeah. And the reason why I think that one is so relevant for us, and it's probably a nice way for us to wind this up and finish, is I'm constantly saying to the industry, the last thing any salon needs is more clients. And of course, that gets people to think a little bit. And by the way, I'm not just playing with words here. I'm not saying, you know, guests or client, yeah, whatever word you use, guest, clients, that means the same thing. Customer. Now, it's the word we use to describe customer.
Yeah.
The last thing any salon needs is more clients. We desperately, desperately need more fans.
Yeah, cool.
Clients, guests, or customers, they will shop around. Fans will never leave you.
Yeah.
And I use the word fans. Seth Godin talks tribes, but it's the same principle. Is building a community around you that are absolute fans of what you do, and those people will be with you forever.
Well said, and you're right. It's a good way to wrap up. And so I really appreciate, you know, you've given us just so much interesting stories today. So I really appreciate your time to come and talk with
Enjoyed
us.
It.
Now, look, I know people are going to come and stalk you and want to find you. You are thefantastichairdresser.com. Is your social media following the same?
So social media probably actually is better. I tend to do more. We do have the Fantastic Hairdresser social media, but actually most people follow me as against that. So just Alan Austin Smith for social media.
Okay,
cool. In terms of that. But we also do have Fantastic Hairdresser, obviously.
Yes.
In terms of the website, which one of you, because there's fantastichairdresser.com and there's thefantastichairdresser.com. The difference is we have a small product line, and the fantastichairdresser.com is the product line. You'll still be able to get there, but it's just thefantastichairdresser.com gets you there quicker.
I will put all the links on this episode so you can go and stalk Alan. And so, look, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And I've thoroughly enjoyed it myself.
Brenda.
It's been very enlightening. All right. We shall talk again.
Take care. And
thanks,
thank
Alan.
You for listening, everybody. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Salon Owners Collective Podcast. Tune in each week as we reveal the latest insight and advice on what it takes to make your salon a success today. Subscribe to the Salon Owners Collective podcast on iTunes or visit us online at salonownerscollective.com for answers to your common questions, to follow Larissa and much more. Thanks for listening. See you next time.